John the Apostle was the author of 5 books of the Bible, and he was the only one of the 12 apostles who did not die a martyr's death. He survived old age despite the efforts of the Roman Emperor Domitian. And John was condemned to death by being submerged in burning oil. He miraculously survived the ordeal and was exiled to the island of Patmos. There on Patmos, Jesus revealed to John the letters, visions, and promises, which are the book of Revelation. And eventually John was released from his island exile, and history suggests he went to the city of Ephesus, where he pastored and ministered in the church of Ephesus until he died of old age. And John's escape from the burning oil is one time when God preserved the life of his servants from death at the hands of their persecutors. It happened at other times, but it is not common in the Bible or in church history. And so this story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it is the most memorable example of God saving his servants from death. These 3 Hebrews incurred the wrath of Nebuchadnezzar when they refused to bow before his idol. So Nebuchadnezzar built a 90-foot tall statue in the plain of Dura. He called the officials of the provinces of Babylon to attend the dedication of that statue. He commanded everyone to bow before the statue when they heard the music began to play. The music began. The huge congregation of officials fell down on their faces before the idol, all except for 3 men. And a group of Nebuchadnezzar's counselors reported to him the Hebrews' refusal to bow. The king was enraged. He commanded them to come be brought to him. He demanded that the Hebrews bow before the idol when they heard the music again. And they absolutely refused. They said to him, "We do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." And that brings us to verse 19. So let's begin reading there. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So this section starts with Nebuchadnezzar full of fury. He is enraged by the Hebrews' response, and he is so furious, he commanded the furnace be heated 7 times more than usual. Now, this furnace was probably a huge kiln of some sort, maybe for baking bricks or for firing mortar, and it was more than large enough to accommodate 3 men. And we know the kiln would not have been equipped with a temperature gauge of any kind. And so Nebuchadnezzar's command to heat it 7 times hotter cannot be understood as literal. Nebuchadnezzar was not commanding them to turn the heat from 600 degrees all the way up to 4,200 degrees. He was commanding them to heat the furnace as hot as it would go. He gave the command. Slaves added fuel to the furnace. Other slaves stoked the fire, and the temperature climbed. And the Hebrews were tied in their garments, in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, all the rest of their clothing. And this indicates the haste of the king. He wanted them in the furnace now. Because this was a kiln, it probably had a very large door on the side where the material to be fired could be brought in, and then after it was done, taken back out. So the Hebrews were taken to this door and thrown inside. And the guards were in such a hurry to obey the king that they stood too close to the opening. Maybe when they opened the door, the flames shot out at them. But whatever happened, the furnace was so hot that the heat pouring out instantly killed the guards. And it gives us in this passage details about the Hebrews' clothes and the guards' death, in part to show the marvelousness of the Hebrews' deliverance. They were not thrown into a slightly warm oven that they later crawled out of with singed clothes. They were thrown into a furnace so hot it was fatal to those outside the kiln. And the Hebrews were thrown into the kiln wearing items which were incredibly flammable. Some of their clothes should have caught fire instantly. Verses 24 and 25, it says that Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king. Look, I see four men walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." So despite the unsurvivable heat, the Hebrews did not die when they entered the furnace. They fell down in the furnace and their bonds were burned off, but their clothes did not ignite. They stood up, free of their bonds, and began to walk around the kiln. And the kiln was likely built with a firebox underneath the floor. So the material to be fired would be set on the smooth surface of the floor, and it would be heated by the flames underneath, but would not be touched by the flame. And the king's command to overheat the kiln probably meant there were flames shooting up the walls. And so these three Hebrews were not incinerated. They were not dead. They were not burned. And they were not bound. They were walking around the furnace, surrounded by flames, without suffering any ill effects from this fatally hot fire. And the king was astonished, I think to put it mildly. He was even more astonished to discover they were not alone. Somebody else had joined them in the furnace. Nobody goes and just takes a walk in a kiln. And yet somebody has joined them there. But even more remarkable about this was the fourth man was visibly unlike the others. So Nebuchadnezzar could not quite describe him. What he could say was the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. So this figure was a startling supernatural presence, which is even more surprising than the Hebrews' survival in the furnace. Now, there in verse 25, the last phrase, the Son of God, that phrase raises some interpretive challenges. If you're reading from something that's other than the King James or New King James, your translation probably says a son of the gods. And the words that Nebuchadnezzar used actually are very straightforward. There's no question about the words. What he meant by them is not so clear. So the word he used for God was plural. So he might have meant gods. The challenge there, though, is one of the Hebrew words for God is Elohim, which is a plural word. And so when the Old Testament uses the word to speak of Jehovah, we translate Elohim, God, singular. When the Old Testament uses the word to speak of the false gods, we translate Elohim, gods. And so it's a very common name for the God of the Bible as well as pagan gods. Nebuchadnezzar is speaking in Aramaic. He's not using the Hebrew words, but he's saying basically the same thing. It's essentially the Aramaic version of that, and it's a plural word. Now, because The Hebrew name for God is plural. Some have interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's word as saying that the Hebrews' God had come down to save them from death. However, we have no reason to think that Nebuchadnezzar knew much about the God of the Bible. So I am very confident that Nebuchadnezzar had no understanding of the Trinity or of God the Son. And since Nebuchadnezzar used the plural word gods, I do think it best to understand him as meaning to say a son of the gods, which in fact, if you look down to verse 28, you see that Nebuchadnezzar declared his belief that the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego sent his angel and delivered a servant. So Nebuchadnezzar thinks that the Hebrews' God sent a messenger. Did not come himself, but sent a messenger to deliver the three Hebrews. So even though the God of Babylon did not know God the Son, and he had no true theology of God, that is not the case with Daniel. Daniel the prophet and the first Jewish readers of Daniel knew God had a son. The Bible had spoken of God's son long before. In Psalm 2:7, God says to a future powerful king, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." In Proverbs 30, verse 4, the wise man asked of God, "What is his name and what is his son's name?" The Hebrews knew God as a Trinity and knew the second person of that Trinity is God the Son. The book of Daniel uses the king's exclamation in its erroneous theology to point us to the conclusion that the figure in the fire was the second person of the Trinity. And so even though verse 25, I would say the New King James and the King James technically mistranslated this Nebuchadnezzar's word, theologically, they got it exactly right. How's that for trying to have both and at the same time there? But what we have going on is Daniel is teaching us something about God. Nebuchadnezzar thought this was a messenger of the gods. Those who understand the Bible's teaching about God ought to recognize that these three Hebrews were protected from certain death by the Son of God. So that God himself stepped into the furnace with his people and God himself answered the king's question, who is the God who will deliver you? The God who delivers is the God of the Bible. He is the personal God who is present with his people, even in the fire. And this presence of Jehovah with men was quite different from the presence of the gods of the Babylonians. The gods of the Babylonians involved themselves in the lives of men. Most famously, the god Enki warned Gilgamesh that the gods were going to destroy all people by sending a flood on the earth. The Gilgamesh epic discusses that. However, the involvement of Jehovah in the lives of people is unlike, entirely unlike, that of any of the mythical gods. God created man directly. He formed man out of the dust of the earth. He walked with man in the Garden of Eden. He personally confronted man when he sinned, and he personally pronounced judgment on man. God confronted Cain directly when he murdered his brother. God gave Noah instructions on building the ark. Jehovah met and talked with Abraham. God came down to see the wickedness of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah before their destruction. He spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai. He spoke a second time on Mount Sinai to all of Israel. He visibly led Israel through the wilderness. He revealed himself to Joshua outside Jericho. He spoke directly to his people through his prophets. For centuries, God spoke through his prophets. No other God is so directly and so completely involved in the lives of his people. The same God of the Old Testament is actively involved in the lives of his people today. He is the God, and he alone is the God who became flesh and dwelt among us. He is the God who hears and answers the prayer of his children today. He is the God who abides within us and never leaves us. He is exercising the same personal care for us that he showed to these three Hebrews. Now that does not mean that he always protects us from all that would do us physical harm. There's no promise in scriptures that God will always protect us from all that would do us harm, even the persecution or persecution for his name. In fact, we have a long testimony of in scriptures and in church history that often God permits his children to suffer both torture and death for his sake. So it doesn't mean he will protect us from physical harm, but it does mean he will always be with us. He will always give us sufficient strength and grace to obey and glorify him in all of our trials. He will never permit us to be tempted without always ensuring that there is a way of escape. He will always equip us and enable us to do his will at all times. Though he is not visibly present with us as he was in the fire, he is always present. And when we go through those fiery trials, he promises that he will continue to be with us. He continues to exercise the same care for us that he showed to his servants in the Old Testament. He is a very present God. He is a very personal God. The pagans believed their gods sometimes heard, sometimes answered their prayers. But there is no mythological God that ever promised to answer prayer like Jehovah has promised. None showed themselves so willing to so frequently intervene in the affairs of humanity. God is the one who heard the pleas of Sodom and Gomorrah and agreed to not destroy it for Abraham's sake. We know there wasn't the minimum number found. But God agreed to answer Abraham's prayer. God answered Moses when he interceded for Israel. God heard Hezekiah's prayer and gave him 15 more years of life. God heard the prayer of Jonah from the belly of the great fish. God heard over and over again the prayers of his saints and answered them. And God hears your prayers today. He listens to your individual prayer. Not just a massive group of prayers that are sent up and some angel sorts them out and brings them to God. God hears your individual prayers. He answers your prayer according to your specific needs and his precise plan for your life. God desires one-on-one fellowship with you. So he is not a distant God. He is not a corporate God who only deals with the large crowds and the big picture. He is a God who deals with the details, with the individual, with the personal, and with the intimate. If you are a Christian, God is your God. Personally, uniquely, and intimately. So that he is just as personally involved in your life right now as he was in the furnace with the three Hebrews. Let's read verses 26 and 27. Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. So Nebuchadnezzar saw the unharmed Hebrews and the fourth man with them in the fiery furnace. He called them to come out of the furnace. And when the Hebrews came to him, they were completely unaffected by the fire. Their clothes had not been burned. Their hair was not singed. They did not smell of smoke or fire in any way. The gathered officials clustered around and examined them. And no one could find any sign that the Hebrews had been in the fire. So that which killed the powerful guards of Nebuchadnezzar outside the furnace did not affect the three Hebrews in any way. This is an astonishing miracle. It's an impressive display of God's power. Again, it's an unmistakable answer to Nebuchadnezzar's question, who is the God who will deliver you? God says, me. I am. And in response to God's deliverance of the Hebrews, Nebuchadnezzar issued a decree. This decree went out to all the provinces of Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar expected all the people in his kingdom to hear and obey his decree. So this decree really is as close to a universal proclamation as it was possible to get in those days. Word of this would certainly reach beyond the borders of Babylon so that the Persians, Greeks, and Egyptians at least would hear rumors of what happened to the Hebrews in the furnace and how the king responded. So let's read his decree in verses 28 and 29. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. This decree of Nebuchadnezzar's is the climax of the story of the fiery furnace. Verse 30 is the epilogue. It tells us of the promotion of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But the climax, the peak and the point of this account is verses 28 and 29. And so when we read the story of the three Hebrews in the fiery furnace, we are intended to focus on what Nebuchadnezzar declared. As I said a couple weeks ago, one way Hebrew storytelling makes its point is by building to a final climactic declaration. We are familiar with this method of teaching from fables, like that of Aesop. So we know the fable of the tortoise and the hare teaches us slow and steady wins the race. The true story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego teaches us no other God can save, can deliver like God. The evening of September 11, 2001, dozens of members of the United States Congress gathered together for a press conference and a moment of silence in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks. After that moment of silence ended, the gathered legislatures spontaneously began to sing God Bless America. Do you remember the effect that had? Do you remember seeing that? Christians were astonished and thrilled. Many took the legislators' actions as a sign that maybe America is returning to its moral senses. Believers began to talk about revival breaking out in America. And the decree of Nebuchadnezzar was an event of that nature. It was a completely unexpected acknowledgement of God. His decree hinted at a changed heart and pointed towards good things for Israel. And the captive Jews may have hoped that the king would begin to worship Jehovah. Unfortunately, the king's decree was no more evidence of a spiritual change in him than the Congress's actions 25 years ago. Though the effect of the king's decree was not as much as we or the Hebrews may have hoped, his decree is vitally important. Because in this, he gives praise to God. He says, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's a simple declaration of praise, but what it would have done is elevated the God of the Israelites across the Babylonian Empire. This is a God that Nebuchadnezzar publicly acknowledges. He tells what God has done. It says he sent his angel and delivered his servants. He told of the commitment of the three Hebrews. They opposed the king's commands. They put their own lives at risk rather than worship any god except theirs. And because of what God did for his servants, Nebuchadnezzar decreed that anyone who said anything against the Hebrews' God would be executed and his home destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar commanded all people in his kingdom to respect the God of the Hebrews. It's an incredible declaration. The most important part is the final line. There is no other God who can deliver like this. I don't know if this is somewhat of just rhetorical flourish, just to sound impressive, at least on Nebuchadnezzar's part, but the statement he makes is that the God of the Hebrews was unique among all the gods of the world. The Babylonians had dozens of gods. The world around them worshiped hundreds of gods. But the God of the Hebrews did something that none of the rest had ever done. He had intervened to save the life of his servants. And God's actions in the lives of his people showed him to be unlike all the gods of the nations. And the same is absolutely true today. Now, we live in a day of undisclosed idols. Many people give their devotion and adoration to a wide range of objects. Many people turn to things for comfort, security, peace, identity, purpose, or meaning. They treat those things as if they are gods able to give what only the God of the Bible gives. The problem with these idols is that they do not appear like idols. Nobody builds a statue of the TikTok logo and bows down before it. At least I hope nobody has an altar where they sacrifice to dollar bills. But they're still gods. And we need to recognize them for what they are. And we need to recognize that God is greater than all of these gods, all of these things that people trust in and live for. We need to hold firm to the conviction that God is unique and He alone can deliver. And what this means is that we need to be very diligent to forsake the idolatry of this age, so that all the things the world treats as most important, social media, football, economics, politics, work, retirement, technology, we must treat all those things as secondary. Now, those who are wrapped up in idolatry will often think we are treating their gods as unimportant. They will wonder, how can you survive without my God? They will think that we are odd and out of step with the world, and they'll be correct. We will be out of sync with those around us. We will not be conformed to their view of life. We will think their gods are frost, designed to waste time and distract hearts from the things which truly matter. We need to recognize those things as idols. Now, I don't mean that we throw away our phones and unplug our TVs, quit our jobs, and just live in a farming commune together. I mean we must always recognize that the things in this world that it values most don't matter. I mean, it's just that simple. They're unimportant. They may be a pleasant diversion now and then, but your life should be unaffected if you miss the World Series or the Super Bowl. Your life really should not be impacted if you do not know what is on Instagram or what is in Anthony Fauci's diary. We should love God And you can continue to love God. You continue to love your neighbors. You can continue to serve one another and preach the gospel without adoring what the world loves. Because the gods of this age are just a cacophony of shrieking voices trying to get our attention. And they make many promises, but they're absolutely powerless to keep them. They are adored by millions, but they are not lovely or beautiful. The entire world runs after these things, thinking that in their gods is meaning and purpose and answers to the question which matters most. And their gods are distant, empty, impersonal, and powerless. They have no answers. The God of the Bible alone is God. He is truly most important. And he shows this by his unique activity in the lives of his people. He is present with you. If you are his child, he is present with you. He is working actively in your life to accomplish eternal good. So you should be able to see the hand of God in your life. You should be able to speak of answered prayer, of his blessings and guidance and protection. You should be able to say, I know God is working because of this. Because of what he did today, what I saw in his word this morning, how he encouraged my heart in my time of prayer. You should be able to say, I know my God is real and working because he answered this prayer. He brought this one to salvation. He did this. He's uniquely working in the lives of his people. And there is no God, no mythical God that has ever been that works like God does. And because of that, God matters most. Because he matters most, you should be much more concerned about missing your time of Bible reading than you are with missing the game. You should be much more concerned about missing your time of prayer than you are with missing the latest post. Jehovah is absolutely unique. He stands above the pantheon of mythic gods as the only one who is real, powerful, personal, and present with you. The God of the Bible must be most important. Do not let anything distract you from loving him most.